Hi, Dog Mamas. This is Dana Brigman of the Canine Coach Carolinas and a well-oiled canine. This podcast is dedicated to all things natural wellness for dogs. We'll spend time talking about nutrition, essential oils, homeopathy, and other things that you as a dog mama can implement in your own wellness journey. We also take this opportunity to remind you that this presentation is for educational purposes only. Nothing in this is intended to diagnose, treat, or cure any disease or illness. This is not intended to replace any veterinary care. You are encouraged to discuss your own medical concerns and the individual needs of your pet with your veterinarian. So now I invite you to come, sit, and stay well as you enjoy the show. Hello, dog mamas and dog lovers. It's Dana Brigman from the Canine Coach, and I have with me today my friend, Paula Vandervoort. Paula is a trained aromatherapist specializing in animal applications. She is also a professional animal communicator and the only Natural Rearing Breeders Association credentialed natural rearing boxer breeder in the world. She has helped people keep their pets well for decades as a wellness consultant, blogger, and social media teacher. She holds numerous credentials related to naturopathic animal healing and a BS in animal science. Paula is also well studied and deep into research on epigenetics. I'm excited to have her here today to talk to us about what natural rearing means, natural wellness in the breeder's world, and the show dog space. And I hope, if not today, well, let me rephrase that. Today we are going to talk about epigenetics, but welcome, Paula. Glad to have you here.
Thank you. Happy to be here.
Glad to have you. So I know that you and I met some years ago at a veterinary medical aromatherapy conference. You and I were both going through that certification course, and then they had a big annual conference for the members. And then we met again a couple years later out at a animal conference that was more things holistic. It wasn't just about essential oils or aromatherapy. It was many other things. And at that point, you were talking about epigenetics. And I got really fascinated with the story that you told about your dog who had degenerative myopathy. I'm saying that right. Am I not?
Degenerative myelopathy.
Myelopathy. Mm-hmm. I always sometimes span that word together in with like DCM, canine cardiomyopathy, and I miss that. So would you repeat it? DM?
Degenerative myelopathy. It's Lou Gehrig's disease in a dog.
Got it. And so tell us a little bit more about that and what epigenetics is and how it can help change the course of health for some dogs with these predisposed conditions.
Okay. I'm a dog breeder for many decades, and as I was sort of traveling through this journey of trying to be the best dog breeder I can and doing all my health screens and raising my dogs in the best way I knew how to do, which was came out of my college education, which mm-hmm. was all traditional medicine. I was observing that the lifespan of my breed of boxers is going down, not up, and also vitality is going down. And I'm seeing dogs dying at very young ages mm-hmm. of things that they may or may not be genetically predisposed to. And the two major causes of early death in boxers are cancer and heart disease, mm-hmm. cardiomyopathy. Yeah. But one of our genetic issues that tends to run in the breed and in many other breeds, in fact, I think it's found in every breed at this point, is degenerative myelopathy. And that is, it's pretty simple. Set of two alleles that get inherited, but it has to be triggered. And that's the part I didn't really grasp at first. I just thought, you know, well, if you've got the two alleles for degenerative myelopathy, you're going to get it at some point. you're going to express that disease. Well, that's not necessarily the case. Last time I talked to the folks who were doing the research, about 10% of the dogs with both alleles for it were actually expressing the disease. Well, what's happening with the other ones? And then over time, that statistic got a lot worse. We were having a lot more dogs that were developing disease and much younger. Mm-hmm. It used to be known as an old dog's disease. And I happened to have a dog that had two alleles for DM, degenerative myelopathy. And so I went on a journey with her.
And does that mean that both her parents are sort of carry? I'm just trying to understand the genetic piece of that, but it had to happen in both her parents in order for her to have both those genes, or is it some other way that it shows up?
Yes. Both of her parents have to contribute one allele that is a diseased allele, or it's actually called a negative. It's a mm-hmm. negative allele for DM. Okay. And so if they inherit no alleles for DM, then they can't express the disease. If they inherit one allele, they are carriers, but they usually don't express the disease. If they carry two alleles for the disease, then they are at risk of expressing the disease.
Right. So in your breeding path, you can test for that before breeding, right?
That's correct.
Which means if someone is a carrier, then would you just never breed that dog, or would you just not breed with another carrier?
That's a really good question. And I remember when we first got that gene test thinking, well, that's what I'll do. I just will test and I will never breed a dog that is going to be carrying two alleles for DM. Well, I had to eat my words because only 17% of the boxers are actually clear of DM.
Wow.
So if you're only breeding 17% of the population, you're condensing the gene pool too much, and you have a much greater chance of bringing forward all kinds of other diseases. Mm-hmm. So we just don't have that luxury. So we do get a lot of dogs that are in the breeding population that are at risk. They're carrying mm-hmm. alleles for it. And so the science of epigenetics helps us a lot to understand how to not trigger genetic predispositions. And so when I was in college, I learned that, you know, it's kind of like you get what you get when you inherit genes and you figure you're going to get that disease. You know, your parents are diabetic or whatever, you're going to get it. But that's not necessarily true. The science of epigenetics, which is a lot older than people think it is, but it's just kind of only recently been getting a lot of press in the human area, is showing us that there are epigenes that sit on top of genes that turn them on and off. Mm-hmm. And those are triggered by environmental things.
Okay. And those environmental things, are there food, chemicals? Are there other factors? Are those even factors?
We believe they all are.
Okay.
And there's not a lot of research in the animal field, but mm-hmm. there is a lot in humans. And I live in the Houston area where the big med center is, and there's a lot of research that goes on here, and there are treatments that are in place for humans who inherit genetic diseases, and they're literally turning them off. But and it has to do a lot with methylation. I mean, I teach mm-hmm. this in conferences and stuff, but basically the belief is that there are environmental toxins that turn these bad genes on, and that once they're turned on, they get inherited that way. And so the converse is also true. If you can turn those off, then they get inherited in the off switch position, and after 3 or 4 generations, it becomes permanent.
Yeah. So you just touched on something that the question was in my head, because I've heard you talk about this before with the number of generations that it can take to sort of make sure this isn't happening. Can you speak a little bit more about sort of how far back this goes? And
I wish I knew for sure. You know, the research is in animals is fairly limited. Mm-hmm. And there've been some research done in fruit flies, and you can get thousands of generations in those.
Fast, yeah.
Yeah, pretty fast. And in mice and so forth. But the data is showing that we need at least three or four generations before we start seeing that, you know, there's some permanent effects from it. And that's really exciting, because if we can turn these genes off, even though they're present,
right,
you know, you've got a dog that's got two alleles for DM, and you're kind of thinking, well, if they live long enough, they're going to get this, and it's not a pretty disease, and it's fatal.
Yeah.
But if they never express the disease, and then they're able to be bred, and their offspring don't express the disease and live a long time, and so forth, you know, we're in the early stages of all of that,
yeah,
but we're seeing some exciting developments in it.
So I'm going to circle back to the breeding piece of this and all, but, you know, the epigenetics not only applies in something like DM, it can be part of a cancer issue or other diseases. True?
Yes. And it's funny, if you go to vet school and when they get to talking about boxers, they call them the cancer breed.
Oh, dear.
And wow. Yeah, because our top cause of death is cancer, or early death is cancer, or heart issues, cardiomyopathy. And at this stage, anywhere from 50 to 70%, and I've even heard as high as 90% of dogs are now being diagnosed with cancer. And that was not the case when
I started. Did you say 90% of dogs are being diagnosed with cancer?
I've read different numbers.
Wow.
On the low end, I've read 50. On the high end, I've read 90. Well, somewhere in there.
Yeah.
You know, if they live.
I mean, I've heard certainly more than 50%, something like 1.2 out of 2 is a number that I keep hearing in today's world. But 90% is scary. I mean, 50% is terrifying, but wow, 90% is just, I can't even wrap my head around that.
Yeah, don't quote me on that, but I, yeah, you know, I follow a lot of the vitality and longevity researchers, and, mm-hmm, you know, the numbers are pretty scary. And my point is that when I first started breeding decades ago, this was just not happening.
Mm-hmm.
You know, dogs weren't dying of cancer so much. They were, you know, they were living a lot longer, and they were more vital. They were having, you know, better lives. And
yeah,
now, why are all these dogs getting cancer? And for a long time, you know, people think that cancer in my breed is genetic,
yeah,
which it does have a genetic component to it.
Yeah.
But 90% of cancers are environmentally triggered. So that's the human research, at least.
Yeah.
So
go ahead. I'm sorry. Go ahead.
I would just expect that there to be a parallel in animals. Yeah.
And those chemicals, I just want to sort of repeat this, because I'm hoping that we'll have a lot of new pet parents out there, or people that may not have experience in these topics, but it's all the environmental factors. It's the things that are in a home. It's the food that they're eating. It's the flea and tick topicals and orals and the shampoos that we're putting on them, right? I mean, it's all of these things that... And correct me if I'm wrong, because I'm fascinated by this and I keep trying to learn more. But even with this epigenetic thing, the body can fight back and resist turning that trigger on for quite some time until it says, okay, I'm just beat up enough and I'm going to flip the bits, right? So when people say things to me like, I've used it for years and never had a problem, I want to say, well, lucky you. So how does that work for you? Can you tell us more about that?
Yeah, I guess so. I mean, yeah, some of us are lucky. And sometimes you don't see what's going on right, the inside. And I like to say that my dogs are beautiful on the inside as well as the outside. I mean, I raise show dogs,
mm-hmm,
so they're pretty to look at. But I see an awful lot of show dogs that are not beautiful on the inside.
Yeah.
And you may not realize it if you don't know what to look for. And for a long time, I wasn't sure what I was looking at until I got a more discerning eye,
okay,
about what toxic damage actually looks like in a dog. And, you know, I'll follow, I'll head outside at a big dog show or whatever, and I'll see the top dog out there spewing, you know, bloody diarrhea. And on the surface, he looks very healthy.
Wow.
But, you know, and maybe people are talking about that, maybe they're not. But, you know, I think it all comes back to what you were, I think, headed for, was that we have, I call it an army of soldiers in our immune system. And like in any army, there is a limited number of soldiers. Mm-hmm. And if those soldiers are off fighting wars, are off fighting skirmishes that have to do with being fed poor quality diet, or they're dealing with systemic insecticides, mm-hmm. i.e. heartworm medications, mm-hmm. or parasite warming medications, right. or things like that, then they are, when something big hits, like, you know, that they have a genetic predisposition to cancer, and their cellular structure starts getting damaged because they're being exposed to maybe carcinogens in the nursery or in the home in cleaning products, then there aren't enough soldiers to deal with it. You know, they're being attacked on all sides, basically. Okay. And so then the big thing happens, you know, these people who say, well, you know, I've been using this for years and nothing's ever happened. Well, how did your dog die? Well, the answer usually is they had a catastrophic illness, mm-hmm. at the end.
Right. That's right.
It cost them maybe $10,000 or $20,000 to deal with, or they ended up having to put the dog down because they couldn't afford it. Wow. And that's not supposed to be happening, guys.
Right.
It's not. We're supposed to, you know, live long, healthy lives and die in our sleep.
Right. So tell us about your dogs, how you really got into this path and what you're doing today in your breeding program and puppy rearing and all of that as a natural lifestyle, and ideally maybe tie it into what others who may not be fortunate enough to have one of your great puppies, but what can they do to live the best life they can for their pets?
Yeah, that's a good question. And then my answer is not just about breeders.
Okay.
Because, you know, anybody that owns a pet will benefit from understanding this.
Exactly.
But I got into it because back about maybe 10 years ago or so, I bought a puppy from somebody who suggested that when I bring him home that I feed him raw meat. Mm-hmm. And I had always been taught to feed, you know, the best high-end kibble, which mm-hmm. is what we fed.
Yeah.
And I didn't know any better. I didn't know
right.
anything.
Me too.
But I was already on a path of my own personal wellness because I had also had a catastrophic illness that I've recovered from through natural living. And it just, like the light bulb went off. I went, oh, wait a minute. I'm eating whole organic fresh foods. Why am I feeding something out of a bag that's heat processed to my beloved family members who are carnivores?
Right.
And in going through naturopathy school, I became quite convinced that dogs and cats are obligate carnivores. They're really not omnivores. Everybody thinks they are, but they're not. They can do okay. They don't die if you feed them fruits and vegetables, but they're not meant to eat that. And it does tax their system. So I went off down these rabbit holes learning about raw diet.
Mm-hmm.
And then that just naturally led to, you know, trying to make it simple for myself and for my friends I was like, you need to do this.
Yeah, right.
All my friends. And then I was looking at all the toxic things that I was using in my home. And I honestly, at the very beginning, I thought, well, I'm just going to get rid of the Roundup, right, in my garage and I'll be done. And I went on a years long journey of going through everything in my house and learning how to read labels, and
right.
really I took probably a dump truck's worth of stuff to poison control that
wow.
were not safe. Yeah. Over and over and over and over, boxes of things. Wow. Everything, I mean, all the way down to like Johnson's baby shampoo that I was using on my puppies. It's not safe.
Right.
It has stuff in it that shouldn't be on their skin. So, you know, so then I discovered that there was a thing called natural rearing.
Okay.
And that there is a Natural Rearing Breeders Association. And that organization has a code of ethics that one can choose to adhere to. And it's pretty strict. And it lies on top of all of the normal things that a dog breeder does, like health screen and do early development work in the nursery and all of that. Mm-hmm. And it does involve some things that are kind of scary to let go of if you have grown up dependent on things like worming medicines or vaccines.
Right.
You know. So there are some things that, you know, you really have to think about.
Yep.
And you have to understand the alternatives that are available.
And so what do you use instead? Right? I mean, obviously puppies get worms and we've got to protect them from the world around them. You know, things like even parvo or distemper, or I don't know how prevalent they are in your area, but they're rampant in ours. So how do you treat them naturally to help prevent those things?
You're going to be surprised at the answer.
Okay, great.
I do it with diet.
Awesome.
I build an incredible immune system on my puppies from before they're born. But it's like a pyramid. If you don't build the base of that pyramid with diet and high quality food, you can't out-supplement that. You can't fix it. You can put a lot of band-aids on it, but you can't, you have to have an excellent grass-fed, grass-finished, organic, if you can get it, high-quality carnivore prey model diet for your dogs. That's number one.
Okay.
That provides the army with the nutrition that it needs in order to fight the battles. And so I very often don't need to treat for anything. And I do live in an area where we have mosquitoes year round in Houston, and we have, it's rainy a lot, and we have hookworms in the soil. When we had Hurricane Harvey, there were dogs dying right and left of hookworm.
Oh, goodness.
And I had a litter of puppies right then. And what people don't pay attention to is the load.
Mm-hmm.
They just get excited because their dog has got hookworm,
okay,
or their dog has got heartworm. And nobody's talking about, well, how many do they have? You know, I have a microscope. I look at it. I count them. And I go, huh, there's not very many there. So that's pretty normal. You know, if I have a puppy that's 3-4 weeks old and they come up hookworm positive or whatever, I'm just looking at the load. And I'm going, okay, well, parasites prime the immune system. They help the immune system to produce antibodies so that if they do encounter that pathogen again or that parasite, they can kill them.
Mm-hmm.
And so they're important. And some of these parasites also remove heavy metals from animals' bodies.
Mm-hmm.
So there's a symbiotic relationship with these creatures. And like it or not, we all have parasites.
Right.
It's just a matter of how many.
And I love that. I mean, I don't think my dogs are that natural. we are natural, but certainly they didn't grow up that way. But, you know, even in like today's world in the show dog space or the competition space or therapy dog space, there are so many rules around your dog has to be vaccinated. Your dog, I mean, I've even heard like service dog groups or therapy dog groups that if your dog is raw fed, you can't qualify. So how do you get around that in like the competition world or the show dog world?
That's a huge question.
I know.
There's a lot of ill-informed people out there.
I think this was going to be easy, Paula.
We need to continue to educate people, but also we also need to understand when it's okay to back off.
Okay.
And I can tell you that I've been thrown out of two training facilities. that I deserved to be in. My dog deserved to be in. I was in a dance facility with one of my naturally reared boxers. Mm-hmm. He had fantastic titers to parvo, distemper, all the things they're vaccinated.
Right.
And we were on the dance team. We were, you know, getting prepared to compete. He loved it. Mm-hmm. And all of a sudden I got called into the office and the owner of the facility said, "What are these titer things you put in his folder?" And instead of giving her a vaccine record, I gave her his titers and she threw me out. She said, "You and your unvaccinated dog can leave."
Oh no.
And so there was no educating her. She had liability issues. She needed that piece of paper in the folder that said he'd been vaccinated. Mm-hmm. And even though vaccines do not confer immunity, that's been proven by Dr. Schultz, Dr. Ron Schultz, and natural immunity is better than vaccinated immunity.
Sure.
It lasts longer. It's deeper. It's to the original pathogen instead of the vaccinated pathogen. So there's so many reasons to provoke natural immunity, but when you go into these facilities, they just don't understand any of that. Or even if they do understand it, they still have to deal with liability.
That's right. They're bound by the state laws or what have you. Yeah.
Right. The only vaccine that is required by law is rabies. Mm-hmm. So I always tell my clients, I'm not telling you to break the law, but you do not have to vaccinate your dog against parvo, distemper, leptospirosis, coronavirus, adenovirus, any of that. Mm-hmm. You can provoke all of that naturally. And a dog that is raw fed right off the bat is going to have a much stronger immune system than a dog that's kibble fed. And even if, you know, they do need to be, get a little extra support for something, there's all kinds of natural alternatives for it. And my puppies have gotten parvo and they literally, yeah, they literally have gone through it in 24 hours with almost no symptoms. You know, they snap tested for parvo. They were a little lethargic. They were like, "I don't want to eat for a while." And, you know, the vet was like, you need to come get your dog because they're so busy. You know, they've got immune compromised dogs, kibble fed dogs in the back and vaccinated dogs that are dying of parvo. And our dog is up front like, "I need to go. I'm having too much fun." And, you know, and yet they have parvo. So,
wow.
People get afraid of these things, and so they end up poisoning their animals to protect them. And when they do get those diseases, they get sicker.
Yes. And so obviously around my area, and I don't know about your area, but in North Carolina, South Carolina areas, there are abandoned dogs in the rescue community everywhere. And parvo is extremely common. And people do tend to sort of panic and think, "Oh my God, this is a death sentence." Now, many of them do recover with traditional treatments, but I've never seen anybody sort of locally fight back naturally, if that makes sense. I've never seen anybody say, "We're going to deal with this in a holistic way." It's always traditional medicine efforts. And you're right. We sometimes have crisis or more problems or problems that we just created for the future that people don't recognize yet. So, you know, so anyway, is there more you can say on that particular topic?
Yeah. Yeah. And I don't want anybody to ever think I'm anti-vet.
Right. Me neither.
Definitely these, you know, a rescue dog who's got parvo needs to be in a vet. Mm-hmm. They need to be getting fluids. They need to be getting anti-vomiting meds, anti-diarrhea meds, whatever it is that helps them get through it. But like if you look at an animal that's heartworm positive, I think a better example.
Okay.
Because people freak out. They're, you know, you run these blood tests and they freak out and they go, "Oh, my dog's heartworm positive." Well, you can be heartworm positive and not have the disease. Just like I mentioned, you can have a little bit of hookworm and no symptoms. Mm-hmm. And your immune system's doing what it's supposed to do. Well, the same thing happens with heartworm. And I used to get all freaked out because I saw those hearts in the vet's office that were all, you know,
all wormy, look like spaghetti in them.
Yeah. Yeah. And you think that's what's going on. But I live in Texas and The wild wolves were hunted to extinction here, and they reintroduced the wild wolf population. They're doing extremely well here. Many of them are collared and trapped, and they have these wonderful preserves. They have access to great prey, good weather. They're not stressed. Well, they're pretty much all heartworm positive, but they're not dying from it.
Yeah.
And that's an example of a naturally reared canine. And yeah, when, you know, when they die and they autopsy them, maybe they got one worm in them. That does not mean they have heartworm disease.
Mm-hmm.
So if my dogs have so far, you know, I use good diet to control, to keep them from getting heartworm, but I also spray them down. If they're going out at a time when mosquitoes are out, I spray them down with some essential oils that keep the mosquitoes from biting them. Mm-hmm. And so far, they've always been negative. And I used to run those tests like every 3 months. You know, I was like always worried.
Yeah.
Now I'm pretty cavalier about it. I run annual, you know, blood screens, and I just throw heartworm into that. If they came up positive for heartworm antibodies, I just, you know, watch them, make sure that they're doing, their immune system's doing what it's supposed to do. I would increase some of their immune system supports.
Right.
And that's what I do with puppies, is I create a very, very extreme immune system.
Yeah.
In the puppies that are in my nursery.
So I'm going to ask you a question that you might not, I think you will know the answer, but or at least have an opinion on. When a lot of people are thinking about doing natural heartworm support, so a lot of people are very concerned about it, first of all. And I was one of them, and I have leaned my way into more natural care for heartworm preventative. But a lot of people use the product that is really black walnut. You probably know the product that I'm talking about. How do you feel about that? To me, when I read that, it's a bottle, it smells nasty, but you would have to dose that basically every single day forever in order to claim that it works. And so I'm just curious what your feelings are on a product like that.
Well, I used it for a long time.
Okay.
And then I got lazy and because it was every day.
Yeah, exactly.
I got lazy and it had to be refrigerated. And I was like, eventually I realized, oh, wow, I'm not using that anymore. I forgot.
Mm-hmm.
And gosh, my dogs are still heartworm negative. And now 10 years later, they're still heartworm negative.
Okay.
And I can't recall what the downside is to black walnut, but I know there is a downside to it. And I'm just saying for my own personal experience, I like homeopathy
okay.
a lot, and I like essential oils.
Me too.
And there are definitely homeopathics that help to raise a dog's frequency in that particular area of that pathogen to help them to fight it off. And as much as it is difficult to envision, every animal and every person has an energy body. We all produce energy. We have an ATP cycle. We have a Krebs cycle. We produce energy with our mitochondria, and that is invisible to the naked eye, but it is definitely visible to certain equipment, and it can malfunction.
Yeah.
And our energy bodies need to be functioning properly, and that's where things like acupuncture come into play, and essential oils also, and homeopathics, they all address the energy body as well, and a lot of traditional treatments don't.
Yeah. Okay. So tell us more about your natural rearing program. Tell us about, I know you have resources and products available that others who are trying to raise puppies, that I know I've reached out to you, and we had a litter of puppies in a rescue group in crisis. And so I appreciate that. But tell us more about all of that and your breeder store and what people, just the average pet mama, can do today. Tell us more about that.
Okay. Well, the average pet mama can learn about raw feeding.
Yeah.
It is not rocket science, and you don't need to be afraid that you're going to ruin your dog by feeding the wrong thing to them.
Mm-hmm.
It's really very easy to do. You just have to get it somewhat right over time is all.
Mm-hmm.
You don't want to be feeding chicken quarters only for 10 years.
Right.
Then you will be feeding an imbalanced diet.
Correct.
But you know, that's important. And then I actually started my store a long time ago to help me pay for raw diet. And I started with one product and I thought I would sell, like, it was a product for dog breeders. And I thought I'd sell 5 or 10 of them. I've sold thousands of them.
Oh, goodness.
And, you know, and I called it the dog breeder store. Mm-hmm. And I'm working towards making it one-stop shopping for dog breeders. But there's no store out there that caters to dog breeders who want to do kind of what I'm doing.
Right.
And so I have a lot of products in my store, some of which I have invented myself, and some I get from really amazing resources that help dog breeders keep their puppies healthy, keep their moms healthy, keep their stud dogs virile. And I take into consideration all the wonderful education that I've gotten from various experts throughout the decades, mm-hmm. and put it all together into one place. I blog in there, write articles. And, you know, some of them are talking about alternatives to antibiotics, for example, or ways to keep a gut healthy. Because mm-hmm. one of the things I see with dog breeders a lot is that they use prophylactic antibiotics very often. They just kind of helter-skelter. They've got like a half-used bottle of amoxicillin, right. or whatever, and their girl is pregnant and they're like, I'm going to give those to her just to make sure she doesn't get sick. Well, they're wrecking her microbiome.
Exactly.
They're killing off the beneficial bacteria and their puppies are inheriting that microbiome, because when they pass through the vaginal canal, they get that microbiome imprinted on them. Yeah. So I write articles about how to fix that. I have products that help with that.
Yeah. And so if you would just speak to that just briefly, I know even when we talk about like a dog with allergies or, you know, some other ailments, that if they did not get that microbiome from their mother, they are more prone to some things like allergies or certain illnesses and whatnot. So can you speak a little bit? And what again, in this rescue space, when we have a dog that's been born or a litter that's been born by C-section versus naturally, what needs to happen to that litter of puppies? What can we do to boost that litter and that mama sort of after the fact?
Well, I had the opportunity to work with a company called Animal Biome, and they're located in Northern California, associated with UC Davis, and they do a lot of research on gut microbiome, mm-hmm. and they produce a fecal transplant product for dogs that have compromised gut microbiomes.
Yep.
And that is, it's a capsule. It's made from poop.
Yeah.
From dogs that
are eating poop, literally.
Eating poop. And my dogs have been donors to that program. I have one of the top donors to the program. I also have had dogs that have been recipients that were more damaged and needed it. So literally I would have two dogs out in my backyard and they're pooping side by side and I'm gathering up the poop.
I need some of that.
Yeah, I'm gathering it up, sending it off to them to process. They're sending it back to me in a capsule and I'm feeding it to the other dog.
Yeah.
But
how would somebody know, because fecal transplants is not something that many people will have ever heard of, and maybe not something most traditional vets are going to be recommending. So how would somebody know their dog might qualify or need that or be a candidate for that?
Well, they can run a microbiome analysis for $100 with that company.
Perfect.
And find out. But I don't want to lose the answer to the question you asked. When you have a rescue dog or a bred dog, mm-hmm. that has a C-section, the puppies are not inheriting a microbiome from the mom. You can do a vaginal microbiome transplant. It's very easy to do. I have a video on how you do it. I consulted with Animal Biome to come up with the protocol. It's real simple.
Awesome.
And you're basically taking a sample of the microbiome from the mother and you're putting it into the puppy.
Okay.
And so I have a video, you know, people can get that out of my natural rearing group
Yeah, and I will share that with some of my rescue folks.
Yeah, it's not hard.
Okay, awesome. So is there any more in sort of this natural rearing category you want to share with us that I haven't already asked about?
I would just say that the most important thing for any breeder or pet owner to deal with is fear. And we have a lot of fear that our dogs are going to get sick if we do the wrong thing. And so we give our power away to people that maybe don't know as much as we do or have different set of priorities. Mm-hmm. Or a different kind of education. I mean, I was educated in veterinary medicine, and so I am, you know, I'm very respectful of all of that, but I've got 15 years of advanced education on top of that in alternative medicine. And so I look at both of those areas, and sometimes I'm in there teaching my vet.
Yes.
I walk in there with my little thing of oils and homeopathics, and we're consulting together about something. This is a cooperative meeting, and I go, well, you know a lot about acupuncture, and you know a lot about herbs. I know a lot about oils. I know a lot about homeopathics. Here's what I would recommend. What do you think?
Yeah.
So if we don't have fear, then we can collaborate. And if we find that there's not a collaboration going on, we need to fire that person, and we need to find somebody that's willing to collaborate with us.
Yeah. I talked about this with a couple of people. Dog mamas are fearful of the raw diet because they've heard that it's going to create all sorts of sickness, right, in the transition or eating the bacteria or the whatever. And then their vets argue with them. Their vets bully them. You shouldn't feed that to your dog. And it takes a lot of confidence to stand up and say, but I am going to feed raw, especially if they don't have the knowledge that you have or the background to say, this is why I'm doing it, other than, you know, they've found a belief in it, or they want to do it, they understand, but they can't articulate it to a alphabet soup behind somebody's name. Do you know what I mean? I mean, I have a client, I went to see them today. They have 10-week-old puppies, two of them. And the breeder gave, and maybe you can talk on this too, the breeder gave the parvo distemper vaccines, right? They can't give the rabies shot, but they gave other vaccines for that first round to the puppies. She then scheduled a wellness visit to the vet, who wanted to revaccinate all of that, even though it wasn't time and didn't count the breeder's qualification or whatever, says that's invalid. And in that case, it was even a vet tech that was arguing with him. Well, your trainer doesn't know what she's talking about and blah, blah, blah. Because I was saying, look, spread your vaccines apart. Don't do them all the same day. Don't load up everything on top of one another. And the vet argued and challenged that, you know, here's this dog trainer trying to give you advice and clearly doesn't know what she's talking about. And I'm like, but...
So let's empower those people.
Yeah, there's a dog mama now standing there going, I want what's best for my dog. And it makes sense in my dog mama head not to do it all at the same time. And the vet's bullying them.
Okay. So at the University of Wisconsin Veterinary Lab, they can send a serum sample from those puppies. And this, let me just say, this is true for breeders. You can send a serum sample from your bitch before she whelps to them. It's called running a nomograph. Okay. It's not expensive. And it will tell you exactly when the maternal antibodies are going to wane far enough that the puppy's no longer protected by maternal antibodies. And the reason why vets are taught to vaccinate on a schedule of doing multiple vaccines over time,
right,
is they're trying to artificially catch that moment in time where the maternal antibodies have dropped to the point where the puppy's no longer protected. Those vaccines that are given before that are useless. They don't confer immunity because they're blocked by maternal antibodies, and they are also dangerous.
They contribute back to this epigenetic problem we're talking about, right?
They are. Here's the pet mamas need to know that those vaccines are loaded with heavy metals, which are neurotoxic. Mm-hmm. They don't work without heavy metals in them. They need those in order to be preserved and also to agitate the immune system, to have the immune system go look at what just got injected and make antibodies to it. They're also full of foreign animal proteins, and they very often set up allergies to chicken and beef because they're grown on chicken egg yolks or beef calf liver serum, and those get injected into your dog, and your dog then forms antibodies to them, and then they end up with a lifelong allergy to that material. So in order to be empowered, you need to sort of understand a little bit about how maternal antibodies work and how they work on a bell curve. The puppy inherits immunity from the mom, and whether she's naturally reared or whether she's vaccinated, they're still going to inherit that from the mom, and it's going to last for a certain period of time, and they'll be protected. Typically, vaccines given at 10 weeks are blocked by maternal antibodies. And the science is showing...
It doesn't boost them if they're already present. Is that right?
They don't need boosting. Any titer is sufficient.
Got it.
Any antibody titer is sufficient. You don't need more.
Right.
You just need them there, period.
Exactly.
And so... Vaccine, you know, what Dr. Schultz is, he was the head of the canine immunology department at University of Wisconsin. I got a chance to study under him. And he worked, he was Dr. Jean Dodd's mentor. And she came out with, a lot of people know her. She's been very vocal about minimal vaccine protocols with breeders. And, you know, their group showed that maternal antibodies very often don't wane until after 18 weeks. It's not true in all dogs, but sometimes you're literally just damaging your dog over and over and over again, giving them those shots, especially the 5-in-1 shots, the 7-in-1 shots. You should never give multivalent shots. If you're going to give shots, you should give one distemper and one parvo several weeks apart after maternal antibodies have waned, and you can measure that. It's not an expensive test.
So I don't know that in all my years in this area that I have ever seen a parvo distemper shot not be in a combo. Are you saying that we can ask for them to be parsed apart and not delivered simultaneously?
Yes. Yeah, those are available. Okay. It's just that the vets don't normally stock them. Mm-hmm. Because people don't ask for them. So. Yeah. You know, you can order them. You can order them from, you know, the places that sell vaccines. You can give them yourself. I don't give vaccines.
I've
had a vaccine damage.
That's your whole premise. Yeah, I wouldn't expect you to. Okay. Oh, fascinating. I think I interrupted a train of thought there, and I apologize if I did that. But yeah, that's a great topic. If you don't mind, I want to circle back to sort of the boxer category for a minute, because they shared the same problem with DCM, dilated cardiomyopathy, that my beloved Great Danes shared. Mm-hmm. And I don't have Danes anymore, but I did, and I fostered for quite a long time. And we always knew it was a common thing. DCM was almost expected in male Great Danes especially, right? And my dog, he was 6 years old, literally dropped in front of me one night. He was out cold. He was 150 pounds, lifted him, carried him into a car, just all on adrenaline, and rushed him to the vet. And he was gone 6 weeks later. And everybody said to me, that's just nature of the breed. As it relates to two things, this epigenetics topic, the food topic, maybe three things, and now what we're hearing in the nutrition world about the taurine deficiency, can you tell us your opinion on that in these breeds that are predisposed to DCM?
Yeah, cardiomyopathy does have a genetic piece to it, but it is very often environmentally triggered.
Okay.
We know that.
I know it now. I didn't know it when I had him. Did not know it then.
Well, we're very fortunate in the boxer world that we have the most heavily funded health research of all the breeds put together. And so we have some people that, and we raised a lot of money to fund research. And we've done a lot of it in cardiomyopathy and in degenerative myelopathy and in cancer for our breed. And some of that has actually helped in the human world. But we know that cardiomyopathy is very often environmentally triggered. So it does play back into epigenetics because, you know, if your dog is of a breed that is genetically prone to it, well, certainly you want to be running 24-hour Holter screens, cardiac screens on them. I own my own Holter system and I run my dogs every year of their life until they die. And I've been doing that for generations. But in addition to that, I want to make sure I'm not triggering anything. And so we know that these grain-free diets are implicated in cardiomyopathy. That is epigenetic. That's an environmental trigger. So that's not genetic. That's diet that's contributing to it. We also suspect that heavy metals being injected into the body and producing allergic reactions are damaging the heart and setting it up for failure. So there are so many reasons not to use toxins on our dogs and to feed a good diet. It's kind of like, why wouldn't you go this direction? Because you may end up with an animal that lives double the lifespan with extreme vitality, and we are seeing it in naturally reared dogs. I have a box, you know, the average lifespan for a boxer right now is, I think last time I saw the surveys, it was between 8 and 10. And I see them dropping dead at 4 or 5 all the time. But, you know, there I had a boxer that was 19 and a half up on the top of my natural rearing group for a long time because they do live that long.
Wow, that's amazing. We don't often hear those, right? We often, I always heard as a Great Dane foster and Great Dane owner, you're lucky if you get 8 years out of them, you know? And I'm like, that, and a couple of other things were really my turning point for getting into nutrition and trying to understand this. And then when this taurine deficiency came out and everybody's like, no, go back to the grain-based diets. I'm like, no, that is not the answer.
Just feed meat. Meat's full of taurine.
Exactly. You don't get meat from grain. You never have. You never, and you won't. And yeah, so I've written a couple blog posts about that topic too, because, and again, I'm not a veterinarian. And sometimes my clients will be standing in front of their veterinarian and saying, but taurine's in meat. And they're like, but the food is the problem. And it's just a nightmare.
Okay. I do understand that because when I was going to a regular vet, and I loved him, he's a nice guy, he used to argue with me when I was first learning how to do raw diet. And he knew I had a background in all of this. And he said, Paula, didn't you take parasitology in college? And I said, yeah. He goes, well, I eat my steak raw. Well done. Because I don't want to eat that stuff live. And I said, once I learned about it, I said, you don't have a pH of 1 in your stomach. A dog does.
Yeah.
They kill this stuff. They are designed to eat the nastiest detritus. You know, they're designed to bury something and dig it up 2 weeks later and eat it, even, you know, as gross as that is.
Exactly.
Because they've got hydrochloric acid in their stomach, and they are designed to dissolve bones. Mm-hmm. And that's what they're supposed to eat.
Yeah.
And so they kill parasites that way. You know, what parasite can live in a vat of hydrochloric acid?
I don't know. So I keep I keep doing my part in education, and I appreciate you joining us to help do that. Are there any key takeaways you want to share? Give us your short version of your website or your breeder store name, and then I'm going to add all the details in our notes that people will be able to see online and make those links clickable. But go ahead and give us your other talking points and those details now.
Okay. I think an important takeaway is this. You cannot out-supplement a poor quality diet. So feed a high quality carnivore diet first and foremost. Secondly, if you decide to vaccinate with an injectable vaccine, once that needle goes in, you cannot take it back.
Get it out.
And very often it's extremely difficult to recover from that. And we didn't talk about this, but I've had an extremely vaccine damaged dog that actually got rabies from a rabies vaccine. So I went down a incredibly difficult and very expensive journey with her that informed a lot of what I do now.
Maybe that's a whole nother conversation for us to have, because that's the rabies miasm you're talking about, right? Mm-hmm. And though your dog was, we all, you know, rabies by definition is fatal. So having the symptoms of that and the burden on the body of that is, and how you have a dog that's alive with that is a fascinating discussion.
It is very fascinating. Yeah. And it's more common than you realize. There's so many behavior problems that are caused by that vaccine. Yeah.
Which is kind of where I get into learning and talking to clients about that topic, because I've seen it and I'm like, I know that's what that is. And we don't, that could be a whole nother webinar, just a whole nother conversation.
I think another takeaway is just be aware that there, whatever it is you're looking at that might be a treatment for something, if it has side effects that you're not willing to have your dog endure, like maybe it's toxic to the liver or something like that, there is very often an alternative that's more natural and just as effective.
Yeah.
I literally at this point have not had, I've had some, like I've been able to turn around MRSA, staph, cancer. I've had a mast cell tumor just dry up and fall off of my dog. That's a whole nother conversation, by using, you know, high levels of antioxidants and essential oils. So just keep in mind, there are very often alternatives that are just as effective and safe. And, you know, you may need a holistic vet or a naturopath or somebody like me guiding you, mm-hmm. but that, we're not practicing medicine because we're not licensed to, but we can give guidance and we can give education, and you can make an informed decision whether or not those alternatives are something that you want to use. So that's an important takeaway.
Yeah.
And, as far as I have like 3 websites, I think. I am a dog breeder, so I have a website called Gentry Boxers, and that's where I talk about it. It's absolutely loaded with content. You could spend weeks in there.
I'm going to.
It's, I don't have puppies very often, but when I do, I'm always thrilled to get them into natural reared homes. Mm-hmm. And that's actually a requirement, but because I'm not going to go through all of this and then have them go to a home and get damage. But I have that. Then I have my online store. My retail store is called The Dog Breeder Store. And I also do some animal communication that's called Kindred Animal Spirits. And then I run a private Facebook group that's called Gentry Boxers Natural Rearing Group. It's by invitation only. Because I really don't want to be, I've never opened it to the public because I just don't want to be, you know, debating the merits of natural rearing with the general public. I don't have time for that. And I want to be in there sharing our challenges and successes with people who are really on this path. And so we have holistic vets in there. We have homeopaths. We have lots and lots of dog breeders. We have lots of pet parents. We have carnivore nutrition experts, and I have my credential in carnivore nutrition.
Awesome.
you know, so we have a lot of, we have essential oil experts. We have, you know, people who are on every part of this journey. There's people that are at the very beginning and people that are way far into it, but all are welcome in that group if they're interested in sharing and learning there.
I definitely am. All right. Well, thank you. I'm willing to let you keep talking as long as you want. I would love to have you come back for the animal communication. I'm so fascinated by that. And I know you say we can all do it. And I keep trying to figure out how. So would love to have some more of that conversation and you know, sort of drill into any of these other topics that you bring to the table, because it's all fascinating to me. And it's nothing but helpful for us as we're trying to figure out how to keep our dogs healthy. So thank you very much.
You're welcome. And if anybody, you know, is interested, I also do professional consulting. So if anybody wants to, you know, hire me for an hour, I'll be happy to help you.
And they would reach you through the Gentry Boxers website or through Kindred Spirits?
You can, it doesn't matter, any of them.
That's kind of how I feel. Facebook. As long as you get to one of those pages, my phone number is the same.
Yeah, exactly.
Okay. Well, thank you. I really do appreciate your time.
You're most welcome.
Stop the recorder, I think. Thanks for listening, everybody. This is Dana Brigman of the Canine Coach and Well-Oiled Canine. I'd love to have you be part of the team. As you are learning more about wellness and natural solutions for your own pets, please visit my website, caninecoach.dog, for a lot more information about nutrition, wellness, and behavior for your dogs. If you're interested in learning more about essential oils specifically, please visit my page, welloiledcanine.com. And we'd love to see you in our group. It's a Facebook group called Dogs Well Oiled and Well Fed. You can find it by going to the group section of Facebook, and our name is Well Oiled Canine. We look forward to seeing you there, and I would love to help you with a wellness review or any questions that you have about full hard dog nutrition or essential oils, homeopathy, or wellness for your dogs. Thank you, and have a great day.